Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Monday, December 13th, 2021, and today's show, the first hour, will be a replay of my interview with Richard Moss, author of Inside Out Healing, among other things, and Michael and Jeannie, or Michael, or Michelle, will be here for the second hour.
And I generally like to just start out with a question like, can you tell us how you got into the work you do and what drives your passion for it, and then we just let a conversation happen.
Sure. How did I get into this work? You know, synchronicity, things that happen that you don't expect to happen, that are like the breadcrumbs into the labyrinth and so forth. You know, So I studied medicine. I went to medical school in New York City. Then I was coming out for my internship, and we were driving cross country with all I owned, which was next to nothing, in a rented van. A man joins us at our campsite. He's not wearing very much, bearded guy. And when I was traveling with two friends, two women, and they went to sleep, we had a bed rolled out on the side of the van. And he just said to me, you know, of course, what the purpose of life is. And I went, what? No. And he said, well, it's really to learn to love. And then he told me that he was a member of a Sufi order and had been a Sufi for a long time. What was so strange was that it was dark of night, and he walked up with firewood, and I never did see the car. And then he went back to his car, apparently. And then I got into my internship. I finished the internship. Then I was in my residency, starting out in the psychiatry residency, and I heard two of the older residents talking about a new meeting of seekers after truth. And I went, oh, I'm interested. It was a longer conversation with that gentleman at the campfire. And so I met Claudio Naranjo, and who was a psychologist from Chile. And this was the San Francisco Bay Area. And I was on a path. I began to learn to meditate and other things. And that path kept unfolding. I got introduced to the people at the Los Angeles Center for the Healing Arts, which were a pioneering group of Jungian analysts and psychiatrists. And they were they knew how little we really knew about illness and cancer and what's typically called the mind-body connection. Well, long story short, I started deeper on a path that eventually took me out of medicine. I had an experience that changed me utterly, at least it showed me that there's a dimension of reality that we don't usually explore. And that was when I was 30. And then I began to do this, what I've been doing now, which is sitting with people in groups, primarily in groups. In fact, COVID has for the first time really changed my focus from groups to individuals and couples. And so the essence of what changed in me, in the language I would use now, is that where we suffer and where all people suffer is within a structure that we call me or I or self with a little s. And in that structure, which a baby's not born with, which is why I think Jesus says you have to be like a little child. I don't think he's talking about just innocence. And I think he's talking about there's still no, the baby hears, but there's no hearer. It sees, but there's no seer. And it takes 7, 8, 9, 10 years of development before that self-system is really consolidated. And in that miraculous first 8 years, let's say 9 years, we manage to overcome the traumas, the bad mirroring, the pain of our parents, the failures of their relationships. And it's always a spectrum from really the best that you could hope from parents to really some pretty hideous circumstances. But we manage to become me. We manage to become I, and that self-system dominates us for the rest of our lives. And within that, there's a thing we could call the ego. And for me, the ego is typically meant by mind-body, the mental thinking processes, like our beliefs about ourselves, our beliefs about others, the nature of what we select from the past, from our memory, to justify our present moment emotional reaction or something. See, I don't really think at the level of me or I, we have a past. We have the past that serves our anger or the past that serves our happiness. We select whatever memory supports the mood or the emotional reaction or the in the present moment. And that's what the mandala of being was about. It was about this mental emotional link is what dominates people. It's the source of suffering. You don't suffer because you have physical pain or you're getting old. You suffer because you say, I hate this, or I don't want this, or you talk about yourself in the negative. I'm not good enough. And these are all thoughts. I'm a failure. I didn't try hard enough. You know, you failed me, the blame cycle. These are all thoughts, and every one of those thoughts simultaneously, instantaneously creates an emotion, anger, hope, resentment, bitterness. And that's what we see in our world. We see people in these structures, and they have awareness within their structure, the awareness to improve themselves in athleticism or playing the piano or in anything else, the awareness to join a particular group and be in service to that. I mean, our awareness is enormous. Everything from, I mean, look at what we've created, from music to architecture to science. But we usually don't get into a deeper kind of awareness, an awareness that's really linked to the body in the present moment. And so the way I language it is, by 8, 9 years old, the assemblage point of consciousness is me. And if it never changes, that's as far as we go. But there is a possibility of a transformation, a true change that's profoundly healing. And that moves the assemblage point of consciousness to awareness. So for me, consciousness is a relationship. This is what we do, my wife and I, and for many, many years, it's 46 years for me now, since I was 30, well, 44 years, but I was dabbling already before I was 30 and just sitting with people and shifting from conversation at the level of the ego to the possibility of a relationship with fear, as opposed to all the thoughts about it, all the planning to be safe, a relationship to loneliness, instead of all the thoughts that reinforce that, a relationship to sensation. So that kind of awareness, when the assemblage point is capital A awareness or capital C consciousness, is always in the present moment. And so it's not in time, and it doesn't have an agenda. Whereas as a me, as Richard functioning at that level, assemblage point me, our consciousness, our awareness is always strategic. We do things to get a result. And if we talk about self-awareness practices, mindfulness, meditation, people will say, I had a bad meditation. But that means they're in the past remembering an experience they didn't like. Or they say, oh, it was so wonderful, I went deep. That means they had a pleasant experience they do like, which is going to set them up for saying in the future, oh, this wasn't a particularly good meditation. But if consciousness is truly a relationship, if we can teach ourselves that, if we can dig deep enough and say, wait a minute, I say it sometimes this way because it surprises people. What are the feelings that have never felt safe in you? Has fear ever felt safe in you? Have you ever felt anger without thinking? Is it possible to be angry without first thinking? And what's underneath anger, if anger happens a lot in your life? What's underneath fear, if fear happens a lot in your life, is there maybe something deeper? And what if we made those deeper feelings safe in us? How could I possibly do that? Well, you learn in the present moment to come into your body and start to recognize what you feel, and you begin to learn to hold it with compassion and love. And those words are misleading in a way. They're pointers. What I say is, you'll see my bandaged hand. I just had surgery yesterday for carpal tunnel. I say, in the present moment, how you're presencing, how you touch, what you're experiencing determines what you're experiencing. So if you don't like what someone's saying to you, right, in that moment, if you don't like it, you're going to fight or withdraw. You're going to react. You're going to judge. If you can sit there and wait, whoa, that person just caused me to feel this. That's so interesting. I know that feeling. And you take responsibility for the feeling activated by that other person in you, activated in you, not by the other person. See, the self system at me says, you make me feel this way, or you do this to me. That's a rough, very rough outline of 45 years of growth and change and working with people and living my own path. I truly know that I'm not Richard in the sense of me, and that I am in a functional and in the world sense. I truly know that I'm the relationship with my experience. And how I touch loneliness is how I experience it, how I hold fear. How do you make fear safe in you? Well, because you'd say, fear makes me feel unsafe or terrified. And I'd say, you're absolutely right. At the level of me in the self system, that's what fear does. But what about fear itself? What is fear? You know, it's certainly our first teacher of survival. Look at all the animals. They're alert, they're alert, they're alert. You know, but it doesn't serve us now, fear.
One of the things that I saw in your work is this clear distinction between so many of us, when we're talking, dealing with other people, we interchange the idea of the word or the thought feeling and the thoughts about emotion. They're the same. My feelings and my emotions are the same for a lot of people. And you try to draw a clear distinction between those two, whereas emotion relates to the effect that I feel when I experience when I put thoughts to these energy flows, right? Can you say a little bit more about that, how you distinguish between this word feeling and this word emotion?
Yeah. Simply, in the way that I'm making the distinction, emotion is the feeling or the sensation caused by a thought or a reaction to a perception. But feeling is a mode of consciousness that's quite distinct from thinking. So this constant looping between the mental and the emotional, constant. When a person finds themselves sitting and, you know, looking at the ceiling at night and just rehashing something over and over again, I know that what they're doing is, you know, that's creating anxiety, or that's creating fear, that's creating sleeplessness. And then they'll have stories about sleeplessness. But what I know is that underneath that is a feeling that hasn't been met, and it's trying to come forward. Often in the middle of the night's a great time for that, because we tend to be more vulnerable. So feeling as a mode of consciousness gives you information in the present moment. It's very interesting that Buddha basically said consciousness for human being is sensation. In other words, consciousness isn't an abstract consciousness, abstract word. For me, consciousness is a relationship. It's a ceaseless interaction relationship. And that relationship is occurring in the present moment. At that level, waves could happen. A woman contacted me some months after her son committed suicide. She had worked with me for a number of years. She had been in what I call a mentoring program, where I take relatively small groups of people, a dozen to 20, 16 people, for 7 days, twice a year for 3 years, which is long enough to be with any teacher. And we worked a lot on her son and his troubles, and her stories about her son, her stories about herself as a failed mother, her stories about her husband as not showing up, her stories as about the institutions, you know, that are supposed to help, at the schools and the social, that, you know, they all. So she lived in the anger of that, and she lived in the judgment and the anger all the time. And we worked and worked and worked until she understood that all of that anger, all of that judgment, all of this, that was the poison. So the emotions poison you, even the ones you like, because they set you on a line for their opposite. I mean, people will talk about hope. Hope and fear are parents. They're like heads and tails of a coin. And trust is a very different emotion. Trust is a feeling, a true feeling. I'm in relationship to myself now. I can always be in relationship to myself. Things may get difficult in the future, but things have been difficult before. And I've always been able to be present in myself. So trust is, or faith, if you will. God doesn't abandon us. The reality is profound and deep, and love doesn't abandon us. And we find our way to that, and then we have faith that wherever we are in the future, no matter what happens, I still have that relationship with Source, or I still have that relationship with myself. So to me, things like trust and forgiveness and humility and compassion, those are true feelings that emerge from getting more and more grounded in our bodies and present. Whereas, he doesn't love me, anger, or he doesn't love me, sadness. I should do something. I should leave, fear. He doesn't love me. He should love me. I'm not good enough. I've had people, that women in particular, that are so incredibly high functioning and very successful, but deep down they have this core belief they're not good enough. And I always say to them, and what does that create? And they said, well, it, you know, makes me heavy. It makes me work harder. It drives me to keep doing better. But what's the feeling? What's the actual feeling that's underneath the belief you're not good enough? Because it's just a judgment. You're not good enough. So feelings are like the language of the present moment. They're like music, ever changing. If you start to feel fear and you open to it, then it becomes vulnerability. And if you stay vulnerable, then you become much more receptive, much more intuitive, and much more heartful. And so there's no bottom to the relationship with these darker, difficult feelings. You go deeper and deeper, and the deeper you go with the fear, I often say fear is love's ally. And if you have two people that are afraid to get closer to each other, that's the limit of how much they can love each other. But if they face the fear and hold the fear, then they'll risk deeper relationship. So love says, you know, fear, fear is what shows you that love is worth fighting for, that love is worth working for. You can't bow to fear and have love. You can have a narrow little slice of love for your grandchild or your grandchildren or your own children or some of your children, but you can't. You know, wherever there's fear, that's the threshold of love. Wherever there's distrust, that's the threshold of love. So that differentiation of emotion is always created by thinking, and that's the only way I would think of an emotion. So anger, resentment, bitterness, judgment, hope, self-importance, self-defeat, all of that is mind-made, thought-made. And most of the time, if you can recognize I'm telling myself a story about the other person called he doesn't love me or she doesn't care or on and on, then the moment you realize it's a story and that it's making you unhappy and you relax and come back to your present moment breath, come back to this moment, then you realize that that person is just like you. They're the victims of the emotions created by their thinking. And you know, you don't have to defend yourself from that person. You can be present with them. They may or may not be people you want to get closer to, but often they're people like your parents or your spouse, and it's a pretty good idea to stop the stories and the emotions.
And so with that, you're basically, without mentioning the word or describing it, you're basically describing the process of working with the mandala of being, that model you created where this present moment, you know, you call it this focused spaciousness. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that as an experience, but that's the center point. And when I'm in that, there is no story. And there's an entirely different experience of my energetic presence and my safety. And if I get into a story about you or me or past or future, then I'm going to create all those emotions you were just talking about, right? Good, bad, or otherwise.
Right. It took me a long time. I guess I became conscious of the notion of the mandala model around 1996. Because I kept asking myself a question, why am I so clear? when I'm with a group of people and I'm focusing that group and I'm listening to people and I don't become emotionally engaged, and then I go home and have an argument with my wife, you know, or distance myself or feel judgmental, or what am I doing differently? And I would contemplate, what am I doing differently? And that's when, way back, when I went through this experience of fundamental change, I didn't know what was happening to me, but thank God I had studied medicine, and I'd studied some psychiatry. I knew I wasn't psychotic. I knew it wasn't a seizure. I knew this. But to center myself without understanding even that what I was doing, I was sitting there and going, now your mind is in the past remembering how you were. Now your mind is in the future anticipating that this will never stop and you can't bear it. Now you're judging yourself because you think maybe you're weak or something's wrong. And I just kept talking to myself, literally talking to myself out loud or silently, just trying to understand what my mind was doing. So fast forward from 1977 to 1996, why am I different at home with my wife than when I'm working? And suddenly I'm walking around, I've got this beautiful Tibetan carpet on the floor of the gathering space. It's here now, in this place. And it has a mandala in the center, a very simple one. And I'm talking to this group of people about an insight. And I'm standing in the center of the mandala. And they said, when I'm working with you, I'm much closer to the center, like when I'm rock climbing, like when I'm dancing, like when I'm skiing. You know, I'm in that zone. My mind isn't in time. It's not purposive. It's not strategic. It's just what I'm doing, the inner and the outer, are kind of the same thing. I'm unified. And when I'm teaching, when I'm working, and there's this presence in me, I'm doing that. But I go home and I get into me, Richard the ego, the historic Richard, with his problems with his mother and all of that. And I'm now judging. So I'm walking around the mandala. I'm walking over to the 9 o'clock. If you thought of yourself as sitting right in the dead center of a clock, and to your left is 9 o'clock, and to your right is 3 o'clock, and in front of you is 12 o'clock, behind you is 6 o'clock. When you're in those moments of flow, like I was just describing, you're in the center, right? You're not in stories about yourself. But, you know, if you're going down a fairly challenging ski slope, and you suddenly say, boy, I'm really doing great, here, you know, then here, suddenly just the thought
is, here comes the ground. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So just to give people the experience, you just imagine you're sitting in the center of a circle and you've chosen to come into the present moment where you're really aware of your breath, you're in your body, you've stepped out of time, and to your left over at 9 o'clock are all the ways you judge yourself, positively or negatively, all the ways you inflate yourself or deflate yourself. I'm better than him. I'm not as good as she is. You know, I'm not smart enough. I deserve more. All the I, me stuff. It's all over to your left. And that's going on in your ego, in your self system. But that's how you're in the middle now. Over to your right at 3 o'clock is all the judgments of other people and all the judgments of everything. Like for a logger and you're out in the forest, trees are a commodity to be cut down. For an environmentalist, trees are a precious resource to be protected and cherished and cared for. So different stories, because people have different values and different, you know, things that they're doing. And what we know is that a baby isn't born with me, you consciousness, subject, object consciousness, that takes a long time to develop and stabilize. So we have that notion of subject and object, me, you, and oh my goodness, it's a downpour. I can hear it. So behind you are all these things. It's a deep ground of memory. But so I call those the past stories. So that's the positive nostalgia, the negative nostalgia. So if I take, for instance, if you're angry at someone, right? And then you look into the past and you remember all the things that person did that had gotten you angry before. Or you look into the past and you remember how your father treated your mother, where your mother treated your father, and you select from your memory whatever justifies you being angry, right? So now we have me, you stories in the back. We have this ground of the past, but it's not really memory. I mean, it's memory, but it's psychological memory, and it's constantly changing, and it's being selected. It's not right remembering. It's not this is the actual situation, because at the time that memory is imprinted, you have a particular consciousness, and so you imprint it in a certain way. Then we know that those kinds of memories, especially strong emotional memories, are reimagined every time you have them, and they're reimagined according to the mood of the moment. In that sense, there's no true past at the level of the ego. There's just what justifies my anger, my sadness, my fear, my resentment, my bitterness, my neediness. And in front of you at 12 o'clock are all the ways you can imagine the future, but we actually know that nobody can know the future, so that the future is truly imagined. But when we're a me, we don't actually have a future. What do we imagine? We imagine some form of the past that might be better, and that leads to hope. We imagine some form of the past that could be worse, and that leads to fear. And so hope and fear, we swing between those. And those are the stories in the future. And if you look around at the world of people, you go, wait a minute. What? There's almost a tsunami of fear in our world now. And that leads us to a different subject, which is why are we so susceptible to fear? And how does the left brain and right brain and the nervous system really work and other kinds of things? But that aspect of my work that has to do with presencing and being in the body and feeling, the mental emotional process is stories about myself, stories about others, what I'm selecting from the past and how I'm imagining the future. And that creates the present moment activation in your body of fear, anxiety, heaviness, contractedness, hopefulness. But that circle around you, there's that assemblage point is the consciousness of the me that a baby doesn't have. And that then most of us never let go of. And when you look at these epidemics of fear, you realize that if you don't start with really something that's true, your mind will create a rationality for anything. I mean, you can start from, what is racism? Blacks are inferior. There were, intellects arguing, hundreds of years ago, African Americans, in those days they were just Africans or black people, they're only good, the slave people and people in Europe and then, they're only good for labor and having babies. Of course, it's nonsense. But if you start there, then you select the evidence all the time, the way you look at people. And then if you treat them a certain way because of your belief, then it's just an endless looping of hopeless stupidity. And you're trapped inside of it. And you don't have any freedom from it unless grace comes along and whacks you on the head. Like that song, Amazing Grace.
Talk about a little bit more about these two words, focus, spaciousness, and that center of that conscious awareness of the now. How did you get to the focus, spaciousness concept?
Well, how do you describe a state? I mean, the problem is language gets to a point where you either have to be in poetry or you kind of have to be singing or something. But the state of being truly in your body in the present moment with your mind silent, not activated, is a state of precise perception, right? That is, you see colors vividly in a way you hadn't seen them before. You hear sounds vividly in a way that's clearer and more distinct than before. You feel yourself penetrated by the natural environment, the natural order. In fact, your body responds to just walking in the forest with a drop in your cortisol levels, your stress hormone levels. And, so you're so awake. Everything's so sharp and clear. And in that sense, focused and precise. But there's no beginning and no end. It's not outside you or inside you. There's no you, really. The witnessing consciousness steps into the background. So when I try to describe the state, as you move away from the me, you, past, future dynamic toward that center, which athletes know to a certain point, when you look at lives of exceptional athletes, you look at the quality of focus that they can have, how they can tune everything else out, and yet they can see, the context in which they're performing, whether it's Tom Brady as a quarterback or some great golfer like Tiger Woods, everything else is excluded. They're very, very focused and they're spacious in the context of that activity, but they're not spacious in the context of day-to-day life necessarily. I don't know them personally, but we all know that. You know, people who function very high in one level, exceptionally high, way, way above the norm, but are so, so limited in other ways. When you really are grounded in the present moment, how do you describe it? So I call it focused spaciousness. Sometimes I call it relaxed readiness, because most of the time when people relax, they get sleepy and unfocused, right? But if they're ready, they're on guard, they're tense, right? But what if you were absolutely ready? I mean, kind of the apocryphal image of the master martial artists, you know? I've heard stories where, you know, the great martial artists, when they're judging others, will sometimes see two contestants in front of them who haven't yet moved. They're preparing themselves, but they have, and they'll declare one of them the victor because they felt one of them's mind move. And if the mind moved, you'd lose. You had to move without mind. So how do you move without mind? Well, gymnasts do that. Athletes do that all the time. And in martial arts, you're taking the contemplative meditative world into a martial, physical, athletic domain. And as I said, these are kind of apocryphal stories. But so when I was trying to language what it's like to be focused and spacious, you know, so if we have an audience now and people want to, if they're not driving or something, if they close their eyes and just take a position in yourself and you say, here am I. I'm at the beginning of myself. Everything, there's only the now, probably the most important, profound insight any human being can have, that there's truly only the now. And what do you experience in the now? You experience your breathing. So as you're breathing in, you just feel your body breathing, but really feel it, not spectator from your head. Breathe out and just feel the body, that sensation, the coolness in your nostril, the softening in your chest, the softening in your belly, and the next in-breath. And with each out-breath, just keep relaxing without getting sleepy. So there are practices that are at the heart of everything I do that are about cultivating and stabilizing the ability to have an anchor in the present moment, which is sensation. So for example, all the trials and tribulations of life, but all the time you were breathing. And when you're thinking about the people you're angry with or you're fearing the outcome of some really disastrous situation and so forth, do you also remember your breathing? Because if you have the anchor of your body breathing in the present moment, you won't get deeply lost in an emotion like fear. You won't go into the future and get lost in distrust and anxiety and terror. So you have to develop an anchor in the present moment in the body. That's the very first step of awareness practice, consciousness practice. And it's not taught in psychiatry. It's not taught in psychology. Though right now we're weaving together the mindfulness practices, the awareness practices, and into our psychological thinking.
Those practices, as you're talking about, we can actually get better and better with practice of identifying the thoughts that pull us out of, you know, as you said, if you're in the moment and you're aware of your breathing, you won't go into fear. And then my mind said, yes, unless I think, oh my gosh, I can't breathe. And then I pour a lot of thoughts into the sensations and I start to catastrophize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you mentioned these athletes that are get into the zone and they sink basketball shot after basketball shot and they don't know why. And or I think of Larry Bird when you were talking about the focus spaciousness, because he would go on a basketball court and not look and pass right to his player who was, you know, inches away from an opponent. And he had that awareness when he was on the court that I think it has to be akin to what you're talking about, that we can develop in this now awareness, this now present moment experience.
Well, yeah, and it's often called meditation practice, or nowadays mindfulness practice, or contemplative prayer. But you do have to practice. If you want to stop being afraid and angry, you have to bring yourself into the present moment so that you can see what your thinking is.
Yeah, how you're creating the anger or the fear. Yeah.
Only you do. Nobody else creates anger or fear in you. I mean, let's there are people who manipulate fear in other people purposely because it gives them power. But they can't manipulate an awake or aware person. They just simply can't. And the ones who are manipulated and become angry, they want to join with a group of similarly angry people. Or the ones that go to church and create a community of fellowship, you know, that's a much better community, especially if you can broadly allow people of different religious faiths or different religious sects the same respect you would give to your own people. But you know, that's sometimes a step too far. But right now, we see that social media allows fear to be spread baselessly, without factual base. And it's so difficult to step into it. And because you know, whoever's listening to us now, I don't know what they've chosen to believe. I'm astonished at how many people don't want to be vaccinated, even well-educated people. I'm astonished. But then again, I'm a doctor, or was a doctor, and I've studied that, and I understand what the history of vaccines are and the evolution of them. But when you go online, and it's an experiment, it's mind manipulation, it's this, or, you know, and you realize none of that's true. It's also like saying the election was stolen when it wasn't. You know, but more and more, if you seed doubt into people and they listen to their own minds, the only ground they have is the emotion of the belief. And if that ground is anger, then they build a world around anger. If that ground is fear, they build a world around fear. And often people that are angry don't realize that they're actually very, very afraid. And people that move into anger very quickly, there's usually something that's hunting them much deeper, a deep sorrow, a deep, deep sadness, or a deep fear, and that's never been addressed. And unfortunately, it's that level of consciousness where most of us live, where we vote, where we make and pass our laws. It's scary. It's scary because we can lead ourselves to misery collectively, and you can never be safe until whatever inside of you feels unsafe, you learn to hold. And you can't do that without an awareness practice. You just can't.
Well, one of the things that I really appreciated about your book, this Inside Out Healing, and I want to mention that people can find you at richardmoss.com, M-O-S-S.com. And when you talk about these very intense feelings, you call them abysmal feelings, and the willingness in your work to go there with people. So it's not just, I'm not looking at the mandala of being or the Richard Moss work for this light stuff. If you've got somebody with a little bit of anxiety or depression, they can go use this work. You're looking at the full experience of us as humans and talking about, you know, what you do with using the same mandala, but, you know, adding a few stop signs here and there to remind me to stop producing thought about this intense feeling or experience and being with it, and how more and more, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but, you know, this My Stroke of Genius, the woman who...
Yes, Jill Bolte Taylor.
Jill Bolte Taylor has been talking lately about the research that says, if you will just be with and not fight, push away or grab onto an emotion, it's going to move through you in about 90 seconds in terms of the neurological system and this energy flow. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that came to mind when I was reading your work on and using the mandala for these more intense feelings.
You know, you remind me that I started an anecdote and didn't finish it. I was talking about the woman whose son was troubled and all the work she did with me about her anger. Well, she called me and she basically said, a couple of months ago, I was driving my car. I got a call that my son had committed suicide. And I had about 30 minutes before I'd get home and the phone would ring and I'd start to have to make plan, organize and this and that. And she said, what was so extraordinary in that half hour? And she said, I opened myself to feelings and it was the beginning of opening to them. She said, I would never wish on another human being, but I never for a moment suffered. And she said, because if I'd done every story, I'd worked with you on every story, every judgment, every form of anger. So instead I could just feel. And so we talk about abysmal feelings. Grief can be incredibly abysmal, but if you don't allow real grief, you'll just go to guilt or you'll go to anger. He didn't do this, they didn't do that, or I didn't do enough, you know. And once you're in the disguise of guilt and anger, you know, the hiding place of guilt and anger, you're not grieving anymore, because grieving is one of the most intelligent and essential of all human emotions. Because it's where we have to allow a constant play. One minute you can be laughing hysterically and really laughing, and the next minute you're sobbing in despair. And it's like 50 different pieces of music are playing inside of you, and you recognize all of them for a split second, but you can't grab any of them. And this, you know, so Jill Bolte Taylor is right, it'll pass through you, but grief won't pass through you in 90 seconds. Grief will... There are so many reminders, so many things that call you back in memory and mind. And both of those systems, the aware system and the me system, they overlap and they're working in parallel. But you can learn. You can learn to stop poisoning yourself with your own thinking, and you turn toward that simple breathing process I was describing. You make a friendship between your consciousness and the sensation in your body of breathing. They become... And so that link between the sensation that's always there and your awareness becomes an anchor in the present moment. And with that anchor, you turn toward the fear. You turn toward the sorrow. You turn toward the darkest despair. And you turn toward it and you touch it softer and softer and softer. How do you touch it? With your breath, with awareness. It's in your body. It's not out there somewhere. You're feeling it. It's there. And if you turn toward it and you just touch it softly, it will become spaciousness. Most of these deepest and darkest feelings are disguised forms of love. They're condensed forms of spacious consciousness. And you have to keep touching them until they teach you. Everybody wants to control fear, feel better, control sadness, feel... But you learn in the present moment to touch fear, and suddenly you feel spacious and relaxed. And then you go, wait a minute, what happened? And then the next time you try to do the same thing again, that doesn't work. So you realize this sensation called fear or despair will open into spaciousness, will open into love when you learn how to touch it, which means the you that's touching is the problem. So basically fear teaches your self system how to relax until the fear can relax in you. Then you begin to develop a body of love, which is a living current of love and joy. And it takes years and years for that to happen in you. But you can't fix it with just medication. When things are extreme, you may be able to diminish them enough. But long-term transformation, long-term healing is the work of a lifetime. And there's really no end to it.
And that experience in the moment is just the movement of life. And to be able to stay open to that rather than try to grab it and hold it or push it away is this touching gently that you're talking about. And it can be taught. I can learn it, and I can strengthen my ability to recognize when I'm in the grasping or pushing away or I'm in the open state.
Mm-hmm. My wife and I just did a three-day, we call it deep work, but it's an introduction to this work. But probably half the time we were guiding some form of meditation, some form of internal self-referencing, in the body relaxing, wanting. Because what people don't realize is the self system is always wanting. It wants to feel better. It wants to understand. It wants to improve. It wants a result, right? But the deeper consciousness is just touching. And if you touch fear wanting, that's like saying to fear, I don't want you this way, but I want you another way, which is like turning to a child and saying, you know, don't be the way you are. You know, and what good does that do? All you do is the child will either suppress itself or, you know, it'll do one of three things. It'll hide from you or it'll fight you or get, you know, angry and rebellious, or it will do everything you want to please you.
I remember listening to Krishnamurti in a talk saying what we really need to do is embrace our negative emotions the way we would a wounded child.
Exactly. As if you were the wisest of grandparents, right?
Toward your own feeling. Yeah.
Toward your own feelings, right? You take them like a child that's been terribly wounded, you know, and feels deeply unsafe, and you stay with that. You consistently breathe with that inside yourself until that child teaches you what it needs to feel safe. So if its fear teaches you how to touch it, how to presence with it, so that the fear is no longer fear, and then it becomes spaciousness, or it becomes openness, or it becomes, and it even can become love, almost in an instant sometimes. Well, really in an instant sometimes. And how are we going to ever make people safe? You can't pass enough laws to make yourself safe. You can't blame enough people for a bad world and then think that if you contain those people, then you'll be safe. And I mean, if you can't make yourself safe through a relationship with what you feel, you'll never actually be safe. You know, are you expecting your husband to make you safe, or your wife to make you safe, or your children to fix your life, or your job to fix your life, or money to make you safe? All of them can contribute to something good or not good in you, but it's really up to you. You know, it's up to each of us. We're 100% responsible for our reactions. See, that's a path. If the people that are listening to us simply say, okay, well, how do I live this? Then I'll say, you have to decide what your awareness is in service to. In other words, you have to decide why you're here. If you decide that creation itself was an act of love, that, as Jesus taught, God is a God of love. Now, if you decide that love is the purpose of why you're here, now your awareness is going to teach you all the ways you stop loving you. You see? And then now you have a purpose. But if you don't have a pole star that you're steering by with your awareness, then you'll steer by the shame you feel one moment, the anger you feel another moment, the anxiety you feel another moment, the hopefulness you feel another moment. You'll be bouncing all over the place without any anchor in yourself, in your body. But the moment you say, wait a minute, I'm here to love, you know, it's kind of, to me, less abstract than saying I'm here to love God, you know, or waiting for God's love to fix you. If God's love doesn't fix you unless you turn around and love God, because how you touch that determines
your experience, right?
God's touch. You are the creator of the gods you believe in. The attributes of that God, which are your belief, create how you choose to live your life. Because other than that, nobody has ever known anything about God. So if someone like Jesus, if Buddha says, you know, there is no independent origination. Everything is karmic. Everything's related to everything else. And if you get into the present moment sensation and you look at the myth of the Buddha under the tree of life in his part of the world, which is the Bodhi tree, it's everything that came at him, he let it pass through. Everything he came at him, let it pass through. But in order to let it pass through, he had to keep relaxing himself. He had to keep letting go of the me. And when Jesus says God is love, he's basically saying, okay, now you change the purpose of your life, and now your self-awareness is in service to how do I stop love? Well, and what fear plus self-interest are the absolute, that will stop love every time. Self-interest plus fear, no more love.
And the point is, just because as you say it, you know, my mind is going, why is he talking about stopping love? And the point is, if I understand how I'm stopping the flow of these life energies through me and my ability to experience love, then I can choose something else and allow that flow and be in the experience of love and have an experience of myself in the world that's dramatically different.
Imagine two people come to make their vows. There's always, usually, most of the time, marriage vows. There's usually someone representing a religion, therefore kind of a symbolic connection to God, and you make your vow in front of God. But to me, the vow is not to love that person till death do us part, but to love with that person, right? You know, because transactions between me and you, I'll love you if you love me, you know. Right now, I love you, and I can imagine nothing but a wonderful world in the future. But, you know, there's a whole lot of shadow in us, and pretty soon the one you love becomes the source of a whole lot of problems. And so the transactions never work. not when love is, you know, you have to have a relationship to love itself. So, you know, if you do your vow, you say, okay, I'm promising to use every bit of who I am and my awareness and everything I can learn about myself to love with you, right? And now when I see that my mind is dividing me from you, do I want to keep going down that road of divided mind? Because as soon as you divide your mind, then you project division into the world and you see
and you experience it. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Exactly. So that's antithetical to love. The divided mind is antithetical to love. You know, if you divide your mind, what will then happen is you'll end up with your category of people who you feel safe with, but you'll also have the whole category of people you don't feel safe with. So there's no end to warfare at that level. There's no end to the misery of the world at that level. And love is choosing us. Love is always trying to find us. I mean, anyone who's observed their life has seen, boy, love has been seeking for me. I've just gotten in the way with booze or drugs or self-pity or bad habits. And then when you get out of the way, life starts to change. And I'm very aware that when we say these things and we're using words, it sounds so much easier than it is to learn to really love with fear, you know, to have a partner that can make you feel so wonderful and at the same time make you so scared, you know, or so, and then what does this mean to love with someone else? Now, what does it mean to want to come back to the center of the mandala and stop the me, you, past and future stories and start again right now? I often say to people after our gatherings, retreats, go home and on the mirror in your bathroom and on your refrigerator, everywhere where you say, who I am begins now. If I'm angry, that means I'm telling myself a story. So find out what that story is. If I'm afraid, it means that's a feeling I need to turn to and stop the stories and maybe activating it and see what's really there. It might not be really fear. It might be deep sorrow. Sometimes when you stop the stories that are creating fear, what's underneath is just spaciousness and ease. You just don't know because we protect ourselves from our depths with this mental, emotional, mind-body connection. And that's not the deeper mind-body connection because the deeper, the big mind and body, that's a body of love. It's literally a current of joy and love in your body. And all you know, it's always there. So the moment you sit down, there it is. You know, when you're doing and you're focused, it's always there, but your attention's somewhere else. And when you make the image of Larry Bird knowing how to make a pass without looking at the person, or, you know, I used to watch this Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan, and you could see the energy change. Michael could change the energy field of the team and of himself in that context. I'm sure that in many other contexts, he's struggles with life like everybody else. I believe I read he had a gambling problem at some point in time. But he was a remarkably aware and awake person on the court. So was Larry Bird. And sometimes we're better coaches than we are practice, you know, players. In my life, I tried to be a really good coach, but live the path myself every single moment. And have found this path and now to be 74 and know that there's nothing that ever can come to me in the future that I won't, I'll meet it with a yes as best I can every time. So there's nothing ever to be afraid of. And the future is always going to be stolen sooner or later. You'll lose your money, you'll lose your health, someone you love is gone. The future that you imagined, it can be stolen in a blink. So the only thing you have is your relationship to yourself right now. And the deeper that is, the closer you are to everyone else. So it's not this, I'm going to have a relationship with myself, and that's kind of narcissistic right. And exclusive. It's not that at all.
Right. This is in that recognition that we're all connected. It's all energy, and just because I can't perceive those energies with my senses doesn't mean they're not there and that I don't live and swim in them. So.
Yeah, and you feel, as your mind gets calmer, your body feels those energies. The body is this, it's the most intelligent part of us. You know, and the feeling intelligence is the next most intelligence. And the thinking is the least intelligent because it can be led astray by anything. You can build crazy realities with your thinking and not believe they're crazy because they seem logical to you. You know, there's so many good experiments that demonstrate how crazy our left brain is, the part that's representing with words compared to the right brain, which is presencing right now all the time. And I mean, we could talk about all these things for long periods of time, but when I sit down with someone, I'm aware of a lifetime of practice in myself. I'm aware of the kinds of feelings that are pushing people into the thinking they have, the wounds of childhood that they're deeply needing to heal. Because one of the things about the intelligence of who we are is that we will try to resolve conflict and heal all our lives. Somehow we will try.
Yeah, we'll try to make sense of it. And I love that you've given people a model in at least these two books of yours, The Inside Out Healing and The Mandala of Being, that they can begin to start working with that on their own if they choose. I realize that...
That was one of those books. Those books were about you can do this yourself. If you read these things and think about them and then make it your own practice, it's life-changing.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today and sharing as generously with your time as you have. And I look forward to following your work.
And I want to thank you because you're helping, you're giving your time to a good cause. And I feel your clarity and heart. And they have a good champion in here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Do be well. And I will check in with you again in about a year and see if you've got any new projects we should discuss.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Thank you.
So that was an awesome interview with Dr. Richard Moss, and we're going into just a few minutes early into the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Monday, December the 13th, 2021, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And Michelle's going to take over for me here in just a few minutes. And but she had a client until 1 o'clock, so she couldn't get on early when Dr. Tim's recording stopped. So she'll be on here in just a few minutes. And I would ask for prayer from everyone who is listening. I started with a cough on Saturday night and yesterday went into headache and body chills and high fever. And anyway, so because we're caregivers for my dad, I went this morning and was tested and I tested positive for COVID. So, I'm kind of at odds at how that happened because we are so careful. You know, we always wear masks. We stay distance. We do a lot of delivery shopping. And so I am not real sure. We did a breath session on Saturday, and I actually hit a new high. And so at first I thought, well, this is just, you know, when you hit a new high, then you can go to the new depth. And I thought, well, maybe this is just going to the next depth. But my dad had a doctor's appointment today, and that's actually why I had asked Michelle if she could do the show today, because I didn't think I would get back in time. But after I tested positive, then I canceled his appointment. So we are all in quarantine at least for 10 days and hold us in the space that this moves smoothly and that we get to the other side of it easily and quickly. So Michael will be on with us here in just a minute, and in the meantime, I'll direct you to our website, which is whyagain.org, and Michael had asked me this morning about putting out on the More page, which is a page that you now can go to from the app, and I actually heard from India this morning, and they're ready for me to test the iPhone, and I told him I just really wasn't all here to do that and make sure that it went through correctly. So that'll happen later. But anyway, under the More tab, we're going to add the CD for the Wellness Through Stillness and just offer that out there for free. With all the things going on, you know, people can put that on. And that might help go into a different state. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. Holding you in love. And welcome, everybody. Glad to hear your voices and hear that your ears are with us. And we appreciate you getting to extend the energy of this whole conversation that's been going on for 10 years to the next level as we work to bring this to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. We had talked last week with someone about the getting into a relaxed state, you know, creating more relaxation in their lives. And back about, 45 years ago, I created a meditation called Wellness to Stillness. And it was on a cassette tape that we had made available way back when. And in the transition from Atlanta to Florida, it kind of disappeared. And one day I got a call from a gentleman in Canada who said, hey, remember when you met in Florida 10 years ago and you gave me this Wellness to Stillness cassette? Well, that's my healthcare plan, and I wore it out, and I need another one. It's like, geez. I wasn't even sure what he was talking about, but after some conversation, we went back and found it in the archives and remastered it. And so we're going to add that to the app. If you don't have the Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness app, you can go to your app store and type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, Forgiveness. And that will show you the world's only forgiveness app. And so one of the pieces that Gene's going to put in there is when you click on the access to our website, we're going to put that at the top of the list. So you've got a free listen to that anytime that you want. You need that relaxation. It goes through balancing the glands, eliminative nerve, digestive, muscular, circulatory systems and such. So come and play. And beyond that, our work for today will start out with reading from Why Is This Happening to Me Again? We are on Chapter 24, coming up to the close of the year, so we're at the bottom. We've just completed the bottom of page 162, and we're stepping into explaining, or actually walking, the character we've been working with for this last year in the book through the worksheet process. And so we're up to step number 1A, which says, I seem to be upset because my trigger, and there's a space here where you write the name of the person, place, thing, or event, and you can do this worksheet process on anything, past, present, future, living, or dead, including yourself. So anything that you can think about and at the same time experience disturbance about, is a fit subject for a worksheet. So it could be the world situation. It could be climate change. It could be anything. So here we've invited him to fill in that blank. And he's doing this worksheet on his baby sister, Amy. And then there's a set of brackets. And you put your own initials in there. So there's a reminder that while I may be thinking in terms of something or someone out there, my upset is internal, and it really does belong to me. So then you very briefly write what happened. And his circumstance, his situation was that Amy was a favorite, at least it's his perception. And then you'll see in that sheet there's a reminder to breathe. In the next blank, 1B, write your feelings. Be sure to use words that describe emotions, not thoughts. You can't feel like she was the favorite because that's a thought. Sometimes it's difficult to say what your feelings are, and the box on the right is a place to draw and describe them, I offer. So for people who are used to avoiding feelings by calling thoughts feelings, we want to bring correction to that and really start to use the word feelings to represent, or emotion here, to represent the sensations going on in the structure, the emotional results of what's moving in us as a descriptor. And then step 1B, this triggers my feelings of, so here's a space to recognize what, and actually we've corrected that on one of these, in our later worksheets. In the early days, we kind of equated feelings and emotions. We've corrected that, and really feelings refer to sensations in our structure, where emotions represent our emotional state. So this triggers the emotion of anger in me, and that's the blank that he fills in. This is easier than I thought it would be, Michael. Good. The next step is a little more of a challenge. The idea with step 1C is to identify the thought you use to cause your feelings of anger. Richard responds, I remember we talked about that earlier, but I'm not sure I quite get that idea. What does identify the thought I use to cause my anger mean? What thought, specifically, do you have to think to be angry about what appears to be your sister being what you perceived as the favorite? And the thought that he comes up with is that Amy had it easy. I never had it so good. And so you can quite easily see that his anger has nothing to do with Amy, but his unresolved pain about not having it as good as she had it. That's a sin, she says. She had it easy. I never had it that good. His voice went up a couple of octaves as he spoke. It was clear that his emotions were still right on the edge from the processing we'd done earlier in the day. He accomplished something uncommon for a man in our culture. He became safe enough to open and be vulnerable. I'm still not quite sure that thought causes my anger, though, Richard added. Well, Richard, how about if you had the thought, how sweet, my sister had things so much easier than I did. I'm happy for her. Well, how would you feel if that were your thought, Richard? Delighted, I guess. So the actuality is the same. The only thing that changes for anger to become delight is the thought you think, right? Who suffers from your negative thoughts, I queried. Well, it is getting clearer for me that I'm the one who causes me to suffer, and it boggles my mind that I do it so automatically. Richard paused as his thoughts gelled. You know, Michael, I understood this concept about 2 hours ago when we were talking and was amazed by the whole idea. Now it's like I'm hearing the idea for the first time. I'm understanding how my thoughts generate my feelings all over again, and it amazes me just as much now as it did 2 hours ago. I can relate to that, Richard. It amazes me each time I teach it. Life works so differently from the way most of us were trained to think. An important question to ask is, who's in charge of what you think and feel? Well, in the past, it's been everybody but me. Of course, he lies to himself, because even if we pretend that it's everybody else, the truth is, it's still me. It's still me doing it. I'm the one who thinks the thought, gee, I never had it so good, as compared to, wow, it's so cool that she has it so great. Whose thought is that? And yet we pretend that it's everybody else. Even after that insight, here's Richard saying, in the past, it has been everybody but me. But I'm ready to change my mind and be responsible for the thoughts I think. I'm grasping that my feelings are a result of my thoughts and the words I use. So I guess I'll start taking full responsibility for them. I'm going to be more careful with the words I use and have more integrity in the way I act. Hopefully, all these things together will improve the results I produce in my life. Great. Then step 1D is pretty straightforward. You simply describe what you want to do to punish the trigger in number one. Punishment might be anything from a sneer, a degrading thought, leaving, or emotional, verbal, physical abuse. And he gets pretty honest here. He says, I want to punish by yelling and getting rid of Amy. And of course, what brought him to this conversation in the first place is he's on his third divorce, getting rid of his third wife. And here's a dynamic that was established in his mind in his relationship with his sister when he was a very young man, and he's still getting rid of the women in his life. And when we wake up to how we inflict pain, you know, often there's people who say, well, you know, there's just been so much water under the bridge that we could never repair this relationship. Well, if you remember, our workshop, Healing Through Relationships, is titled exactly that. It's Healing Through Relationships. It's not healing our relationships. If I say there's too much water in the bridge, what I'm saying is I've already classified you with so many negative judgments that I could never work them all through, and I have too much overwhelming pain in me that I've put into my brain's image of you to ever work it through. And if one chooses to really kick in and do their work, all of that can be cleaned up. And it's through our relationships that we get to heal those dynamics. And so that's what we're here to do, is to create the tools, the understanding of how the mind, body, and emotions work, and how to bring forgiveness, how to bring healing into the fray. So it's a delight to have you here in the conversation. Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up, or anybody in the chat room with a thought for us?
Hey there, it's me. It's Michelle.
Hey there, young lady. Welcome. How are you today?
Yeah. Good. There's nobody in the chat room right now. Just Jeannie signing off. Oh. I didn't realize why she had to cancel her appointment. I saw that in the chat.
So how are you, young lady?
I'm good. I'm real good.
Awesome. Well, anything exciting in your world to bring to the show today? Any questions, thoughts, anything to process, anything to share? Any exciting results you're seeing with the work you're doing with people?
Nothing that is coming to mind. I only got home from Mexico last week, and I've just been focused on trying to adjust to not being here for 3 months. I have a question, though. I don't know if the switchboard changed, because there's like a new like little symbol on people's mark for a hand up. Is that – I don't know – things are different on the switchboard.
Maybe drop a quick text to Jeannie. I don't know. I've never really, well, once or twice I've gotten where I've had to do something on the switchboard, but I really don't know very much about it. That's kind of Jeannie's purview.
Okay.
So I just don't know what the change is there.
Okay. Well, I said she's going back to bed, so I guess I don't.
We'll catch up on that.
How a hand comes up. It looks like there's like a little like glove thing, but I don't know if that's what it was. We'll see.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is, Michael. This is what it means when somebody has a hand up. So area code 610, you are on the air now.
Hey, this is Susan.
Well, welcome, young lady. How are you?
Fine. How are you both? Michelle, haven't heard from you in a long time. Welcome home from Mexico. Good grief. Wow.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's big.
I'm glad you my invitation to call back. Say that again? I said I'm glad you took my invitation to call back. Because I couldn't tell. Like,
yeah.
I talked to Jeannie about the switchboard.
It,
so it looks
it
like you had
up,
your hand
so
up.
I did call right back. Yeah. It hung up, so I called right back in. Yeah.
Cool.
So, Michael, I have a couple of questions. One
Let's
of them
go
has
for
to
it.
Do with the mind shifter that I picked. decisions lock me into a creation that has already passed and is the only thing that can kill me. I wish
yes.
you would explain that one. That's,
should we unpack that one? That's a good one, isn't it?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Especially if you understand how what it really means. So it ties together. It really brings together a whole lot of understanding on how the mind works. But so, first of all, between decision and choice. Decision is an automatic thing that happens to the mind as a result of the law of resonance. So
okay.
if I, we've used the example before, I have two baby grand pianos. I strike a middle C on one of the baby grands, and I look in the second one, and the second piano, I look, and all the strings related to middle C are vibrating. That's mm-hmm. automatic resonance. So resonance creates motion in any field that's attuned to it. Now,
right.
if the second piano had no strings, there'd be no movement in the second piano.
Okay.
It's automatic. So what we're saying is, in the mind, there's this thing called the automatic decision system. The mind
okay.
is a decision-making machine. Everything that it contains is just there waiting to be resonated into activity. If I say, don't think about the color of your car, do you think about the color of your car? No, but the brain cells representing the color of your car resonate. And the mind makes a decision, serves up whatever's in it from the past. So by definition, the fact that something is already in the mind, it's from the past. So the idea of that mind shifter is that if I allow my decision-making machine to run my life, if I call what it serves up to me thinking, then I'm simply going to replicate whatever's gone on in the past because it's all from the past.
Yeah.
You know, you might recall an example you've heard me use earlier on earlier occasions where I define a word as a tool of communication and then offer that, you know, if words are tools of communication, they obviously are indicative of an interaction between two or more people. So if right now, if everybody who's listening to the show would just observe in your mind, you'll notice that there are words running in your mind and you're not speaking them to anybody, but they're running. So words from the past are moving within the mind of everyone who's listening. And if words are tools of communication indicative of an interaction between two, then, of course, the question becomes, who's in there with you? And
yeah.
who's in there with me is that self that Yeshua said, in order for you to live, you've got to die. The self based in that decision-making property that takes everything in the mind from the past and formulates it into a quote-unquote me. It's all
mm-hmm.
false. And
yeah.
it's dead. And if I live by it, I'm dead. It's going to kill me. If I
right.
get out of my decision-making mind and I open my higher faculties, all of a sudden a whole new input comes and I'm not locked into what's gone on in my generations, what's gone on in the past. You know,
right.
The scriptures counsel, you know, look to the lives of the fathers, for ours are but a shadow of theirs upon the earth. If we're living in the shadows of the decisions made by the fathers, for most people, pretty much all of those fathers are dead. If they are, then, and we get locked into their thought patterns, their habit patterns, their decisions, then we're going to end up the same way as they are. If I bring in something new, there's a whole different possibility. Maybe I'm not stuck with the past.
Mm. Good. Thanks.
Does that make sense?
Yep, it does. Thanks. Now I can do it.
Yeah, when I came up with that mind shifter, so I don't even remember now. I was communicating with somebody, and they said something, and that one just clicked in for me. It's like, oh, that is such a good one.
Yeah, it's a juicy one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It opens the space for a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks a lot. I do have a couple of other questions. Unrelated.
Cool. And you did ask a question when you started, but I didn't really get to answer it, and that was, how are we doing? And I don't know if you're on when Jeannie opened the show, but we do have a bit of a challenge in our house. Back about 2 weeks ago, we ended up with needing to get another car because Jeannie's dad just couldn't get in and out of our Suburban. It was too high. So we ended up carefully doing some shopping, but obviously not carefully enough. And Jeannie just got sick yesterday and tested positive for COVID this morning. I've got a little bit of stuffiness
God.
Going on, but I'm actually feeling pretty good. So we're, fortunately I feel very blessed. I've got the Avison here. I got my hand in it, and it's, COVID is being a microcirculation problem. We've got some awesome microcirculation support. So I suspect we'll go through this pretty mild symptoms and be out the other side pretty quickly. But it's a challenge.
Oh,
it definitely got our attention.
Wow. Yeah.
We've been being so careful.
Have you? Good.
And we found out this morning, that when we were buying the car, we had masks on. We were very careful. And at one point, Jeannie was test driving the car, and the salesman came over, and she had her window open. He just stuck his face in the window, and he had previously had COVID. So that seems like the only exposure we might have had, but,
Wow.
So, yeah, crazy. And we've been pretty careful.
Good. Well, we'll keep you in our thoughts. I was thinking about Jeannie and how she did the breathing and did that work, but maybe also, I don't know when this car thing was, but maybe she had already been exposed by then, and maybe that was part of the upset.
Yeah, the exposure was back 10 or 12 days ago, and started. And I was thinking, she had such a huge opening in that still point session that, this is just a detox happening, because one of her old challenges has been lungs. But unfortunately, and we decided because her dad needed to go to a doctor, and, just in case there was any chance of COVID, she went and got tested this morning so she didn't take him out and expose anybody else. So.
Oh, good. Oh, well, I hope it's a light case and passes through quickly.
That's the plan.
Most of the people I've known who've caught it have had an okay time. Mira Rubin, that I've been working with, she went to a workshop a few weeks ago where none of the masking and distancing protocols were observed, and most of the participants, I think, had not been vaccinated, and 5 out of the 12 got sick. And she was pretty sick, but she's getting better, so it's a pretty bad
look. We'll hold her in the space.
Yeah. So... Oh, my goodness, that's a big deal. Well, here you are on the show. Good. You'll have to keep us posted.
We will. We'll be here every day, so we'll let you know.
Okay, good. That's good.
So you had a couple of other questions.
Yeah, I did. One of them is, I've been looking for reasons why I'm an insomniac, and I shouldn't even say it, cancel the thought, because I even think saying it makes it so. I'm aware of that, but I went to a functional medical person the other day and
she
ordered a ton of blood work. She said, when did this set in? And I said, well, right around menopause. And she said, so it might be hormonal. So do these blood tests. And I got them back, and she said, I have severe adrenal fatigue, and I've been on the website reading about that, and of course there's a lot of controversy about whether that's a real thing or not, and the regular medical people think it isn't. However, I have a lot of energy, and it's funny, I do very well on 4 hours of sleep, but I sure would like to figure it out and solve that and get back to sleeping well. So I was just wondering what you could say about adrenal fatigue.
Well, the adrenals are basically there as a guard, And if I'm on guard mm-hmm. all the time because I live in a threatening environment, I'm going to tend to overuse them. If I overuse anything, I'm going to tend to wear it down prematurely. That makes sense to me. So, and I, you know, as a naturopath, I have seen people with what I would consider to be adrenal fatigue, and I think it is a real thing, but that's not the sort of thing that pharmaceutical companies can do much about. Therefore, it's not in their game plan to recognize things they don't have solutions for.
Right.
So I'd be listening to your functional medicine practitioner, and mm-hmm. well, you know, you're doing a lot of it already, looking at, you know, why are you on guard? What are your judgments about self and others that keep you mm-hmm. on guard? And I think you've got the app, and I don't think Jeannie's actually put the meditation in it yet, but within the next day or so, we'll have the Wellness Through Stillness meditation in there. That might be really helpful in getting to soothe that and rebuild.
Okay. Thanks. And the other one is, I have a couple of other questions. Okay, if I just barrel ahead?
Go for it. Let's get you. Absolutely.
CBD has been suggested as a sleep aid. But then I've been reading about how CBD is not one of those FDA-approved things, and so it may have the ingredient in it that it says it doesn't, because the way it's processed is not altogether, I don't know the word, but it's a little bit sloppy, or it's a little bit approximate. And so there's an ingredient in weed, in pot, that they've extracted from this. So you're not going to get the effects of that, but you can use CBD, which is hemp, I guess. And I wondered if you knew anything about that.
Well, CBD and pot are relatives, but they're not, I mean, there is no THC in hemp oil. And so,
okay, well, that's what they're saying may not be true. I don't know why that is, but.
Well, I think when they say, I think we're talking legal definition, when they say no THC, there is in hemp generally such a small fragment that it's negligible, that it's considered to be legally nil. So if somebody were to be smoking pot with THC in it, you know, they'd test stone. If someone were to be smoking the same amount of hemp, they wouldn't be stoned. They wouldn't test as having THC in their blood. Although there is like a minute fraction of THC in pot. And like any other product, how it's processed, I mean, if it's processed chemically, and, you know, I've spoken with people, I'm not any expert on CBD oil, but I've spoken with people mm-hmm. who've used it, that it's one that's really processed without chemicals as naturally as possible.
Okay. Oh, that's good. That's good to know. And the last thing is, my grandson, Jacob, has been clean from all substances, eating well, but is seriously missing, especially the pot he was taking, because that was how he treated his anxiety. And now he's taking heavy meds, which have slowed him down, and he misses the pot. And then he went to see his father the other day, and his father told him that the father himself was thinking of going on marijuana as a way of dealing with neck pain. And this triggered Jacob into a fearful state where he thought, maybe I'm really missing out, maybe pot in the right amounts, carefully curated, gotten through, you know, using a medical marijuana card, which he had, maybe that wouldn't be so bad. Maybe I should go back on that. And here he's talking about that. That's one part of it. And I have made a deal with him that even though there's no comparison, that I would go off sugar forever if he would go off his substances. And for me, going off sugar is, you know, Thanksgiving came and went and they had pie and ice cream and I was looking at it. It's not a big deal, but I do, and you talk about cravings that show up. I still have a sugar craving. And I'm wondering, I eat cherries and some prunes sometimes and blueberries, and they have a lot of fruit sugar, bananas, and I'm wondering, am I really off sugar? I mean, I suppose you could draw the line anywhere in there, but I'm all
well,
off.
Nobody can be off of sugar. Nobody can be off of sugar. If you didn't have sugar, you'd die. Your brain, your cells operate on sugar. It's a requirement.
Okay.
So nobody can go off of sugar. However, there's a difference between eating a cherry that has fruit sugar in it and refining the sugar from cherries and gulping down, you know, tons and tons and tons of sugar. When you say there's no comparison, actually there was a pretty interesting piece of research, and I haven't looked into the full integrity of it, spent a lot of time with it. It wasn't that important to me, but there were some researchers that had mice who have similar pathways of addiction to humans, from what I understand, and they addicted mice to cocaine, and then they put them in an environment where they could either take a hit of cocaine, which they were addicted to, or sugar. And the mice all shifted over to sugar and gave up the cocaine.
Holy crapola, Michael. Jeez. That really makes it seem as if it's the biggest challenge that it probably is.
It's major. It's major. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And major destructive, just like pot, if you're doing sugar. Go ahead. Michelle, you had a thought?
Yeah, I wanted to, on the topic of sugar, having spent almost 3 months in Mexico just recently, that amount of time really gave me immersion into the culture in a way you don't get passing through, and time to really experience it. So I had some restaurant meals and then meals that I cooked at home for breakfast, lunch, dinner didn't really include sugar. It was something that I had to, like, purposely seek out. And it's not on every corner. So at first, you know, a couple weeks, I didn't really miss it. I didn't notice it. But as time went on and the further away that I was from my addiction, the more noticeable, like, thoughts of something sweet coming into my mind. And but what was interesting to me is when I went to look for it, it wasn't really available in their culture. Like, to find a bakery was really, really hard. And when I did and I bought a cookie, I almost couldn't tell if it was like a cracker or a biscuit or a cookie. Like, was it supposed to be sweet? Because I think there might be some sugar in there, but I'm not like 100% sure. And I was talking about this with an American woman who I met there, and the way she said it, she goes, yes, they are very respectful of sugar here, which I thought was just such an interesting way to put it, and it did really reflect their culture, because whether it's like poverty-driven, like more sugar, more expensive, you know, like the teacup thing, Michael, or that just they don't have that, like, need for that rush and that buzz the way American people do. But it was fascinating, because the more I sort of studied it and sort of, you know, sampled more types of food, like let's say I'd order a dessert and I get a flan. And it's really, I mean, eggs, you know, with a little bit of sugar. Like, it's not... sugar's not emphasized there the way it is.
It's not sugar.
And I made
a couple of eggs in it.
Yeah. I made the house I was at had a lemon tree, and there was about 500 lemons on it. And I was going to town with that. So for Thanksgiving, I made lemon bars, which is a real traditional American style. You'll see that in bakeries. You'll see that in people's homes at holidays. And I had all these fresh lemons. So just look at finding ingredients. Trying to find some white flour was really, really hard. It just wasn't available in the culture. and similar to sugar. I had to go to a, you know, I couldn't go to a regular store. I had to go to a special store to get my sugar. And then when I swear the sugar didn't taste as sweet, I pinched some out of the bag. I'm like, it doesn't taste as sweet, which is, I mean, I don't know how that's possible, but. So I made the baked good, the treat, and the Mexican people were really loving it, and I realized they probably never had something that was, like, so sweet, like, because it just isn't around in culture. I had a piece of cake. It wasn't sweet. It was just light.
Right.
So anyway,
well, let's look
thought
at...
it was interesting. It is a culture thing, too.
Yeah. Well, and let's look at why sugar is such a strongly addictive thing when it comes when we get out of balance with it. There's a thing, if you're into gardening, there's a thing called a Brix meter. Are you familiar with what a Brix meter is?
No, I haven't.
Well, a Brix meter is a device that when you're growing, let's say, vegetables, you measure the Brix level, which is the sugar level. And you know that a particular fruit or vegetable is ripe when it hits a peak of the level of sugar. The Brix reading in the fruit or the vegetable hits its ideal. That's when it's ripe and edible. So for millions of years, we've been going around tasting things, and when the sugar's high, we eat it because it's ready to eat. The food purveyors in America, and I might say the food perverters in America, have taken advantage of that, and they've refined the sugar out. They've taken away all of the nutrients that are supposed to be with sugar so that we digest it properly, and they've taken this pure sugar molecule and added it in outrageous amounts to food, and this old, you know, what can I say, like almost ancient survival mechanism of, oh, this is sweet, therefore it's going to nourish me, kicks in. And people lose their ability to really determine what real food is when sugar is added in the way that it is. I think that today, if they tried to put sugar over on people in America, the FDA would jump in a minute and say, no, we're not going to allow that drug. But it's such a powerful lobby now. There's so much money in it that it's been lost. But that's, I think, why it's such a difficult addiction, and there's that longing for it, because it is tricking the mind into thinking this is actually ripe and therefore filled with nutrients. You know, the Brix level just happens to hit its peak when all the nutrients come together in the fruit or the vegetable and at the peak of ripeness, and that's when it's most edible.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then when it comes to pot, my take is, and I know, you know, there are people who, let's say, for instance, are dying of cancer, and they're in a great deal of pain, and they have no appetite, and if they get an appetite, they probably live longer, and they certainly live more pleasantly. And so prescribe pot to them. You know, somebody's dying of cancer. What does it matter, the brain damage that's done?
Yeah.
But when you realize that the half-life of a THC molecule, THC just happens to be the right shape molecule to go into literally the openings in the cells of the body through which nutrition enters and through which wastes are removed. Now, this is particularly pronounced in the brain because that THC molecule goes into the brain cell and it blocks that opening for nutrition and the removal of waste. So now you've got a cell that's starving and drowning in its own waste because of THC. Now, this happens throughout the whole structure, but it's, I think, more urgent to understand when it comes to the brain because of what's happening in the brain. And the brain takes 10 times as much nutrition as any other organ in the structure to use. So all of a sudden, it's blocked and there's no nutrition entering the cell. The half-life, and half-life describes how long it takes for half of something to be metabolized out of the system. The half-life of THC, and there's a range of research estimates, and I don't know which is accurate, but as I understand it, the minimum is 8 days, and the maximum is approximately 8 months. So each time someone takes in a serving of THC and they block the entry for nutrition and waste removal from the brain gets a little funky. They call it getting high. Well, you'll find that when the brain starts to die, it gets high. That's part of dying, the brain dying. And so 8 days to 8 months blocking nutrition and wastes in brain cells, I don't think holds wisdom under any circumstance, except, again, if somebody's dying of cancer and they're going to get the munchies because they're smoking pot and it's going to take care of their pain, you know, have at it. But otherwise, I don't see a place for it. I think it's insane, personally.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of people who have no idea that they could actually live a life of joy and aliveness and delight just because they're human beings, if they have the tools to handle their hostility and fear and rage and grief and guilt and self-condemnation and all of that sort of stuff, you know, people would do that. But, you know, if they have no way to do that, well, hey, let me suck a little weed and I can pretend life is good.
Yeah.
So you might want to confess to your grandson that maybe you took on the bigger addiction than he did. And,
wow, that's nice.
And
my daughter, he got mad at me. She said, "Mom, there's no comparison." And I said, "I know there isn't." Of course, I wasn't I didn't know what you – yeah, I said, but it's the only thing I can offer because I'm not addicted to – I'm addicted to my iPhone. I could do that, I suppose. I mean, but, you know. Yeah.
Well, let's define addiction here. Because the fact that you enjoy something and you use something regularly doesn't mean you're addicted to it. The difference in whether something is an addiction or not is whether or not it's compulsive. So I define addiction as the compulsive use of any person, place, circumstance, substance, or activity to keep from hearing and following our highest guidance, or to keep from dealing with what's real and true going on inside of us, feeling it and dealing with it. That's addiction. So if I like to use my iPhone because, gee, you know, I get to communicate with people, I get to stay in touch with people, it serves me, blah, 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 and I can put it down, I don't compulsively use it, then I'm not addicted, I use it. And I think that's true for anything. I mean, anything can be addictive if I use it compulsively to avoid guidance or feelings.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think I'm a little bit addicted to the iPhone and very addicted to sugar by what you said. I tend to pick up my iPhone if I'm at loose ends, if I'm feeling a little bit anxious and haven't acknowledged that to myself, I'll avoid dealing with it by checking my email. I mean, it's very simple, but I got my eye on it, Michael.
Well, then there you go. So now you know that you use that addictively. So why do people become addicted? They become addicted because something has resonated, pain. At the root of the addiction, you know, I've watched people over the years and they've been forced and coddled and beaten into, you know, stopping their addiction, and they don't. But when you teach them to forgive, to remove the root of their pain, that's which compulsively drives them to use whatever that person, place, circumstance, substance, or activity is. When they deal with the underlying pain, it disappears. And then, you know, you're just a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But good catch. And I'd suggest rather than picking up the iPhone, that's when you pick up a worksheet and do the next piece of work. What's surfacing that's driving this compulsion?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. Okay. Got it.
Sweet.
Yeah. Thanks. My
and Michelle, you
stuff.
May have, you know, Michelle's field is addiction, so maybe she'd have some other thoughts to throw in to augment that or give us a different direction than any of that. Michelle, you have any other thoughts?
No, actually, when you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, man, it sounds like my speech, Michael. So I give people the same speech as far as, you know, looking to heal the emotional drivers that run the using behavior. You know, that's the recovery. And a lot of people come with abstinence to the table, but that's not the same thing as recovery.
Absolutely. There's a lot of dry drunks out there.
Mm-hmm. And the 12 steps really mirrors so many aspects of the worksheet. It's really kind of an easy sell when people who are in working with me already have that foundation of 12 steps, which is, you know, parallels, like I said, mirrors all the elements of the wake-up sheet.
Yeah, definitely fits perfectly. And one of the pieces that I've found in working with people who've done 12-step programs, and it is an easy transition for them, is to give up the traditional belief in forgiveness that our culture and what most people that I'm aware of that practice 12 steps, forgiveness is about, well, I forgave them, you see, or I forgave myself. But replacing that with, no, it's got nothing to do with letting people off the hook. It's about removal of that underlying energetic pattern, whatever it is, and that's what frees people. We actually did a show back, I think it was the second year, if I remember correctly, that we did the radio show. And so that'd be 8 years ago. We did a show where I compared the 12 steps to the worksheet process and how it ties together. And they're a perfect complement to each other for sure.
Yeah. You know, I've got Roma with her hand up. I'm wondering if she has any comments about the topic.
Let's go for it. Roma, how are you, young lady?
I'm great. Thank you. If I have any comments about what?
The discussion about addiction and such.
Oh, let's see. I did have a thought. I was thinking that as far as pot is concerned, you know, if I were inclined to want to do it nowadays, I would grow my own, because I think that the way they process things is part of the danger nowadays. Let's see. What
okay,
else
no
were we
confessions
talking?
Here. You're not over there going, wowie, are you?
No, I don't. I haven't done marijuana since I was in my 20s. But, yeah.
So for the last 15 years, that's good.
Yeah, for the last 15 years.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay, good. No, I don't know whether I have any. I can't remember the conversation. I'm sorry, I'm kind of in present time.
Good. That's cool. That's a good thing. So you have a thought to share with us?
Well, I actually woke up at 3 a.m. and did a worksheet because I was, I answered the phone yesterday. It was my sister, and there's this ongoing situation with her. The phone didn't work correctly, so we agreed that I would call her today. So I woke up at 3 a.m. and did a worksheet. And I have a bunch of questions from this worksheet. Like, one of them is,
Great. Is
the carbon-based – hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're loud and clear.
Okay. Does the carbon-based memory disappear or transform?
My take would be,
for instance,
that
does it transform into that's the question. That's one question.
Okay, so my offering there would be, it's kind of like your computer. If everything you put in your computer into its memory bank, into the hard drive, when it came back up, was called back forward to the screen, it ran your life. That would be like most people living with carbon-based memory. Whatever's in their mind from the past, the decisions from the past, run them. When you apply forgiveness, you've weakened the energy pattern so that it no longer runs you. You have a memory that something happened 30 years ago that was painful and it used to drive your behavior, but now it's just a piece of information in carbon-based memory. It no longer runs you.
Okay. So it's still there. Yeah, right.
Well, the memory, I mean, you're not wiping out memory. The information's there, but it's not, oh, my God, that happened to me. Oh, doing. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember when that happened. Where up
yeah,
until you forgave, every time that was triggered into activity, things went nuts.
I think what shows up, the more healing that we do, genuine forgiveness work that we do, healing, is a kind of an open space. Spaciousness, a sense of spaciousness.
Does do that.
And I was listening to Dr. Tim talk to his guest this morning, and his guest was using the phrase focused spaciousness, and he made the distinction between the difference of emotion and feelings, being emotions are caused by thoughts, they're responses to a thought, whereas a feeling has a it is more of a physical sensation out of the body, out of the organic
right.
body. Yeah. So I thought that
yep,
was a
I'd
good
agree with
distinction.
That.
I wondered if the rest of your family, have you all, are you all going to get tested for COVID now?
No. No, Gina got tested and found out it's ongoing, so we're just going to take care of it.
So you're not going to get tested, and you're not going
to
test the little 3-year-old?
I have no need to. No. Well, she hasn't been with us since any of that happened, and we're making other arrangements for her till the household is clear of it. So,
so that's very interesting, Michael. You're choosing not to test. And based upon
well,
what is
why
that
would
mean?
I? Why would I? It's not gonna. It wouldn't do anything for me. I'm gonna. I am acting as though I have had contact with COVID, and I'm going to do my healing work and treat myself accordingly. It wouldn't add anything to my thinking or my repertoire to have somebody stick something up my nose and say, "Oh, you got it." I don't need that. I don't have any use for that. I'm moving forward as though I have been exposed, and I'm you know. Got my hand in the Avicen as we're talking. I'm taking you know, D3 and C and all the stuff that goes on, all the zinc and such. So, and I'm feeling
it's
pretty
nice
good.
To,
I do have a little, a little bit of congestion.
Like, nice to have a constant buddy like the Avicen to hang
yeah.
out with.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Another yes.
Michael, a couple times you said you have your hand in something, and I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're saying. What do you have your hand in?
Oh, okay. Well, there's a device that we use. You know, the study, I've done a fair bit of study of COVID, and while people say it's a lung problem or it's a sinus problem or what have you, it's actually a circulatory problem. So there's a device that we've been working with for about the last year called an Avicen. And the Avicen is specifically designed to enhance microcirculation. So what we've had reports from people, we actually sell the machine, we carry it as a product. And the reports we've had from people who've gotten COVID and had the Avicen is they have no long-term side effects from it, no extended effects, that they come out the other side of it pretty clean and, you know, go through it pretty easily. That one of the things COVID does is it blocks circulation, and when you end up blocking circulation, you end up with tissue damage, lack of oxygen, lack of nutrition, buildup of waste products, and it creates all kinds of side effects. So, but I'll tell you, if you'd like, I'll give you a call after the show and explain a little bit about it to you.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
Good. I'm glad that got brought up.
Yeah.
You remember in our session days ago, I said that my hands were reaching out. They were reaching up like a baby reaches out for help. But I
right.
noticed as I was doing this worksheet this morning, early this morning, that my hands and my feet were, the energies were, you know, focusing on those four locations, and that the sensation I had was one of climbing. And I thought, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. I thought that was good. I mean, that's definitely a step forward to the sense of helplessness.
Pun intended, right?
Yeah. That was nice. I love... what were we going to say?
I was just going to ask you, has there been any other, since you had that recollection or that realizing that it was like reaching forward, stepping forward, has there been any other insight in that regard since we did the Still Point session on Saturday?
Well, I don't remember anything else. I think the thing that I'm the most excited about is the fact that I'm living on a cellular level. And it was so serendipitous to hear Dr. Moss talk about that focused spaciousness as being cellular and then the distinction. So that's kind of where I live nowadays. And so I'm not engaging too much in the mental stuff, which is part of why I can't remember stuff. But I don't myself a heartache because I don't remember stuff.
Right. If you go back to the Aramaic... Just one more quick thought. In the Aramaic Lord's Prayer, what's been called the Lord's Prayer, there's a line in there that can be properly translated as the kingdom of heaven is the kingdom of expansion, and it literally means expansion. That we're moving beyond this 9-bit mind into the actuality that the Creator created for us, which is where we're designed to live. We've contracted into this little 9-bit space called perceptual constructs, and as you start to let them go, they become less and less important, less and less necessary.
And there's so much more beauty. I mean, there's so much more beauty and joy and the great presence of existence itself available all the time. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So another question has to do with the mass canceling phrase at the end of the worksheet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to read it for those who want to remember it. I commit to love, to living a human life, and then we fill in the blank right after that. To help achieve this, I do a mass canceling of all the times I wanted number 3 from someone. In my worksheet here today was to clear pain, fear, hatred, and move into absolute love. So even though that was a very positive goal, that was what I canceled at the end of that step, at the end of step 3. Which leaves you with being with what is. You know, just being with what is and just being in the question, being in the question. But I'm not sure I understand mass canceling of all the times.
Okay.
Yeah, I know how to do mass canceling.
So with the goal that you just expressed, this step would be a little different than from most worksheets. So let's say that we've got Bill over here, and Bill has a conflict going on with his boss, and his boss is taking advantage of him. So what we now know about Bill is that in his file on relationships with people, there's a reality called being taken advantage of. So his goal there would be perhaps, let's say, to be supported by his boss. So he's going to cancel the goal to be supported by his boss. When you get down to that step you just wrote, and you'll notice there's a place there and a blank line that says initials. So what we're going to invite Bill to do is think about every time in his life that he's wanted somebody to really treat him fairly and be there for him rather than take advantage of him. So he might put mom's initials in. He might put dad's initials in. He might put big brother, big sister. He might put his own initials in. He might put the initials of his first wife, his second wife, and his fifth wife. He might put the initials of his grade 3 teacher. Every time he's ever had that as a goal, and now that the space is open with this specific that I've done in this worksheet, is to open the space for all the times that goal's been frustrated in me, and to clear that whole thing out. Does that make sense to you? And the show's going to cut us off. If it does, then we'll come back to it tomorrow if you like.
I have one more question, which is that when I went to India, your timeline on
we're probably not going to last that long. I think we're down to about 10 seconds, so maybe we could do that 49. Question tomorrow.
Sure. Okay. All right.
No, we're down to 10 seconds. Just gave me the 10-second call. All right.
Okay.
Blessings. Thank
aloha.
You, everybody.
Everybody,
you.
Aloha from
Thanks, Michelle.
Maui.
Aloha. Yay. All right. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye.